Welcome back, everybody. And this is Talking About the Law. I'm the host today, and my name is Frank Riccio. Again, I have the honor of having as my guest Carmen Durso, who is an accomplished trial attorney who represents those who are injured by perpetrators of sexual abuse. Carmen, welcome back.
Thank you.
And we were talking about sexual abuse, and what are the situations in which sexual abuse occurs typically?
Well, there are two kind of main general divisions, Frank. The largest number of kids who are sexually abused are abused by someone that they know in their family. Relative, boyfriend of a family member, someone who's part of the family group. However, the perpetrators with the largest number of victims are people in organizational situations. The largest number of people, for example, that were abused in the Boston Archdiocese Catholic case was 552 victims in 2003. Since then, there have been maybe close to another 500 that have come forward over the past 10 years or so. So you have two different situations. You have these family groups, and you have the institutional situations. And the institutional situations are interesting because you have people who are attracted to youth-serving organizations simply because they know that's where they can get access to kids.
And these are the perpetrators.
Perpetrators, right. And, you know, typically these are people who are held in high esteem in their communities. Priests are certainly highly respected, coaches, teachers. Right now, I'm seeing a large number of cases involving teachers who are sexually abusing students, and remarkably, only because statistically there are more men than women who do this. In education, I'm seeing a large number of female teachers that are abusing male students.
And in terms of that type of situation, from a legal perspective, what do you do? What is your role in terms of these institutional people, especially schools, that type of thing? What are the legal things that have to be done?
Well, the first thing, when someone comes into my office, I say to them, what do you want to accomplish? And to the extent that we are able to bring some sort of criminal action, I explain to people what they can do. I try to assist them with that. And I stay out of the way because the district attorneys are not anxious to prosecute in a case in which they see someone is also making a claim for money. Just to explain that situation to you, we had the Suffolk County District Attorney testify at a legislative hearing several years ago, and he said that his office sees approximately 1,000 claims or cases of child sexual abuse in a year, and they are only able to prosecute about 200. They have absolute discretion as to whether or not they will prosecute. So they look at the cases, and they decide which ones are most likely to result in a prosecution. And if they see any factors that they think are going to be able to be used by defense attorneys to prevent there being a guilty verdict, then those are the cases they're less likely to prosecute. And one of the factors they look at is whether or not someone's simultaneously bringing a civil claim. So we talk about what you go through in a criminal case, what you go through in a civil case if you are the person bringing the complaint. We talk about what the likelihood is of success, because there's a difference, as you know, between the measure of proof you need in a criminal case, which is, if you put it in numerical terms, is almost 100%, whereas in a civil case, it's something just slightly over 50%. So that means you don't have to have as much evidence. That's particularly problematic in sexual abuse cases because frequently there are only two people who know what went on, the perpetrator and the victim. It's rare that you have a witness. It's rare that you have forensic evidence. Everyone watches CSI and they think there's forensic evidence in every case, and there isn't. It's rare. Once in a great while, you might have some evidence of a pediatrician noticing something physical with a child. Once in a blue moon, you might have the perpetrator actually admitting something. That's very rare because most perpetrators don't believe they've done anything wrong. So corroborating evidence is very difficult to come by, particularly for a criminal case, so that for some people, the likelihood that they will be able to prove anything is greater in a civil case than in a criminal case. And what most people want to do more than anything else is to get their perpetrator identified, get acknowledgement of the fact that they were abused, get the person stopped so he can't go out and abuse other people, so that people will know that this has happened. And by filing a civil suit, if they aren't able to go through with a criminal suit, they're able to get a public record which can be reported in the media that John Jones has been accused of sexually abusing someone, and if it goes to a judgment, that there's been a court determination that he's done that.
Now, we were talking about institutions, and let's stick to the example of the schools. Specifically, what has to be done? For example, say there is a teacher, a very popular teacher, which is usually the scenario in terms of who's going to be the abuser. What are the steps? What are the laws that help the injured party bring a claim?
Well, since 1972, there has been a federal law called Title IX. And Title IX says that institutions which receive federal education funds cannot discriminate on the basis of gender. And sexual abuse is sexual discrimination, so that schools are required to prevent that from happening. In schools, you have this relationship that develops among teachers so that they don't always understand that their first obligation is to the kids. I had a situation in which a sister of a boy who was being sexually abused by a teacher went to another teacher and said, "I think there's something wrong going on with my brother with this teacher." And the teacher's obligation at that point was to go and report this to the Title IX coordinator and have a whole process start. And, of course, they're mandated reporters as well under state law. Instead, she went to the perpetrator and said, "Hey, you know, you got to kind of watch yourself. These kids, they'll say all kinds of things about you." So, you know, people are not ready to believe allegations of sexual abuse, and they don't always do what they should. But the law is crystal clear. In schools particularly, because of that federal law, they have an absolute obligation to investigate, report, take action, and they don't always do it.
And if they don't do it, what are the consequences to the school?
Well, there's several consequences. The U.S. Department of Education has an Office of Civil Rights, and they will investigate and they will take away the federal funds that are paid to the school. The individual who's involved has the right to sue in state or federal court under this Title IX law and to recover damages against the school and against the perpetrator.
And do the damages include attorney's fees?
In the Title IX cases, they do. They also include punitive damages against the perpetrator, because the perpetrator can also be sued under a different federal, civil rights statute.
Now, what about state law in terms of filing a claim against a school?
Very difficult, Frank, because we have something called the Tort Claims Act. And the Tort Claims Act is well-intentioned. Its intention is to protect governmental agencies from being sued. And it achieves that purpose because, first of all, there's a $100,000 limit on any claim that's brought. And it doesn't matter whether a child is sexually abused, a child dies. There was a famous case down on the south coast of Massachusetts where people came into a school and killed a kid. even though they had advance warning that it was going to happen, and the court said, no, you're not responsible because of the Tort Claims Act. So the Tort Claims Act is not an effective tool in most of these school cases. And the federal statute, we found, is much more effective in bringing claims against educational institutions.
And the Tort Claims Act, correct me if I'm wrong, really deals more with the traditional theories of tort liability, like negligence?
Well, yes. And if that's all it did, it wouldn't be so bad. But the Tort Claims Act has a special section in there that says that if the harm was caused by a third person, then the institution has no liability.
Carmen, when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about private institutions and other institutional liability on sex abuse cases.